Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Michael Osterlink, and I'm speaking with Tina Benson. She is a modern-day soul whisperer and transpersonal Jungian-oriented coach. Tina has over 25 years' experience teaching, leading, and facilitating individuals, couples, large and small groups in the United States and abroad in consciousness explorations, chakra initiation, meditation retreats, couple and women's retreats, ecstatic dance, voice dialogue, Enneagram, chanting ritual, and travel to sacred sites around the world. She is also the founder and creator of Soul Speaks Project. Good afternoon, Tina.
Good afternoon, Michael. Thank you.
Well, I must say it's a very small world, as we were just speaking about offline. So I met you via Facebook, mostly through Dr. Stuart Tavosky, who was a mentor of mine and has been a guest to my show. And we come to find out that you are also longtime friends with my mother's best friend, or one of her very, very good friends, Gail Cousins, that I knew growing up. So it's a very small world in the Circle Titans.
Yes, very small world indeed, yes.
So you are a soul whisperer. What is a soul whisperer?
Well, basically what that means is that I assist people in listening deeply to the whispers of their soul, to the longing and desires of their soul, and help them connect more and more and more deeply to the wisdom of their soul. Because I find in my own life and in my working with people that when they can tap themselves most deeply at their soul level, there's an infinite amount of wisdom available to them. And it's useful in helping them solve the problems of their life. It's useful in helping them guide them towards the things that they're wanting most deeply in their lives. And it's ultimately the greatest ally that we have.
So, now, I know that you're a big fan of Rumi, and what I'd like to actually do is break my usual protocol and read a poem that Rumi wrote that's also on your website, which is www.soulwhisperer.com, which speaks to what you just spoke about in terms of your own work as a soul whisperer. Would that be okay?
I couldn't think of a better way to start an interview than to read a poem, so yes, by all means.
Fantastic. And while I'm reading it, I do want to get your kind of story, your biography of the unfolding of your own soul and what led you into this work. But let's begin with Rumi. I had been away from my own soul so long, so late sleeping. But that dove's crying woke me and made me cry. Praise to all earthly waking grievers. Some go first, and others come along afterward. God blesses both and all in the line. How to say this one to one who denies it? Who are made of the sky's cloth? And everything is soul and flowering. Everything is soul and flowering. Everything is soul and flowering. Rumi. I love Rumi, and I'm very pleased when I ran across your website to find that you are also a big fan, and you also post a lot of his poems on Facebook as well.
I actually don't post a lot of his poems. I post a lot of my poems that people tend to think are his poems.
Oh, really? Those are your poems?
Yeah, there's almost nothing that I post aren't my own words. However, it has been brought to my attention recently that people aren't aware of that fact.
Including me. Wow.
Yeah, they're almost always my own words and my own poems.
I stand corrected. In that case,
however, is Rumi's.
Yeah. I see his name next to that one. So,
yeah.
Do you have a book of poetry available for people who are not friends of yours on Facebook?
Oh, it's so lovely that you ask. I've actually just finished a book that I am in the process. It's not a poetry book, but it is the journey of my own souls unfolding and flowering, and I am in the process of editing that, and it should be out in publication next year. And then my next intention is to call out the poetry that I've written over the years and publish that as well.
Wow, that's both are very exciting.
Very exciting, yeah. Very exciting.
So would you mind, as I see you post on Facebook, if I borrowed your quotes, gave you credit, and sent them around?
No, in fact, people do that frequently. My poems get shared a lot, and I have never minded that when it's done. It's lovely and an affirmation that the poetry has touched that person and they wanted to share it. So, no, I love when my poems are shared.
Fantastic. Well, good. I'll definitely do that, but now that I know they're yours, I'll give you attribution. So let's talk about the unfolding of your own soul. And I'd like to know, what drew you in your own life to become a transpersonal and Jungian coach and a soul whisperer?
Well, I suppose it goes back as far as age 7, when I had my first spontaneous, what's called numinous experience. I was lying in the backyard of my house on the grass looking up at the sky, and I was in an ordinary state of consciousness, and I, from there at 7, could have said, well, that's a tree, and that's the sky, and those are flowers. And then something started to wash over me, and I was no longer separate from what I was looking at. I was intimately connected to all of it, and I knew in an instant that I was a part of it, and it was a part of me, and there was nothing or no one separate from it or from me. And I was bathed in a profound sense of love, overwhelming, unconditional, ecstatic, loving presence. And I knew that that was also what I am and what I'm made of and what we are all made of and what we all are. And I was raised in a home that had no religion. We were, I'm Jewish by birth, but there was no religion whatsoever in my home. And so I had no objects or images that could help me make sense out of that experience. We didn't go to church. We didn't go to temple. So that experience went underground in my consciousness, but it was a seed that had gotten planted, and I was at 9 voraciously reading Carlos Castaneda. I found a book somewhere, I don't know where, and it was the first thing that I had landed upon that reflected what I had experienced back to me and helped me start to understand that not only I, but other people perhaps had that experience. And so I read everything of Carlos Castaneda that I could, probably by the time I was 10. And then when I was 20, I believe, I had the next very deep, spontaneous, numinous experience. I was working in a flower shop while I was going to college. It was Easter Sunday, as it turned out, and there were no customers coming in the store because everybody had already gotten their flowers for Easter, and I was really, really bored. So I went into the back of the flower shop, and I started weeding the garden with my hands. I got my hands in the earth, and I was actually agitated and annoyed. And what happened was the same thing. My hands were in the dirt. I was weeding the garden, and I was flooded with awe and wonder. And one of the flower designers climbed up a tree to cut down a branch, and I looked at him and the tree and his arm reaching up, and I was just overcome with beauty and a sense of wonder. And the same thing, I knew in that moment that there was nothing separate from that beauty and that awe and that wonder, and that I was a part of it, and it was a part of me. And I knew in that moment that the reality I am usually in is the illusion, and that that reality that I had stepped into spontaneously was the actual truest reality. And I was you know, funny, I was bathed in what felt like Christ consciousness on Easter Sunday, on the day of his resurrection, this, you know, non-practicing Jew. And I was gardening, I was weeding the garden, and I remember thinking to myself, I don't want to lose this experience. I don't want to lose this experience. And the minute I had that thought, the experience vaporized. And that was really what called me more deeply onto my own, what's now been, you know, a 30-plus year spiritual path. I started studying all of the major world religions, and I quite honestly was shocked when I went to the bookstore to find that I wasn't the first person to have these experiences, that the bookstores were filled with spiritual Gnostic mysticism literature that described these experiences that I had been spontaneously having. And so I immersed myself in studying the world religions. I gravitated towards the study of psychology, and in particular Jungian psychology, because of the world of psychology, he was the only one that tapped into a spiritual domain and acknowledged the reality of a spiritual experience, and talked about the human experience through the imagery of the spontaneous numinous experiences that I was having. And then my career, yeah.
Before you continue on your college and into your career, between the time you were 7 and 20, you had your first experience, and before your second experience, what effect did that experience have on you in those 12, 13 years? How did it manifest in your day-to-day life?
Well, it didn't particularly. It went underground because I didn't, other than the fact that I was devouring Carlos Castaneda, I didn't really know how to make sense out of it, and I didn't talk about it. My father was a very rational, scientific type of thinking man, and so and he poo-pooed all things religious or spiritual. And my mom was a little bit more curious, but I never talked about it. I didn't know what to make of it. And, you know, had I grown up in a home like when I traveled to India, and, you know, I traveled and met people who live there and spent time in their homes, the religious iconography is everywhere. It's everywhere in the culture. It's in the, you know, the rickshaw driver has altar objects on their altars, and everywhere you go, these images are reflected back to you. So had I been raised in a home where there was any trace of spirituality or religion, I would have had something to hold on to that began to have me make sense out of what I had experienced. But there was none of that in my home, so I didn't have a clue what to make of it, and I didn't talk about it. And it went underground, and I was, you know, born in the 60s and 70s in Los Angeles. So I went the road of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and had through that journey, probably was the way that I found my way to numinous experience, as everyone else was pretty much at that time. But it wasn't the same thing. Wasn't the same thing as what I was stumbling into spontaneously.
So there's a qualitative difference in terms of states of consciousness, you think, between what happened to you spontaneously at age 7 and 20 and the use of the psychoactive medicines and sacred plants?
Yeah, I would say so. And I would also, for myself, and I know a lot of people who use medicine to do their journey work, and I don't have an opinion one way or not about that for other people, but I have found my own psyche's willingness to open to those states organically to be much trustworthy for me, much more trustworthy. That I have, you know, as I've deepened in my own spiritual practice and through my own sadhana and meditation practice, I have regular access now to those states of consciousness, so I don't personally feel like I need assistance with medicine or drugs. But those do, they are very powerful gateways for people. And they were the gateway I had in my youth, in my adolescence, when I was exploring and experimenting with them at the time.
So in your early 20s then, you started exploring the religion systems and the spiritual systems connected to the religious systems. And that led you to more formal study in school? Is that college and then postgraduate work?
Yeah, so I did get my bachelor's and my master's in psychology, and I was concurrently studying on my own the world's religions and texts and traveling to different sacred sites around the world and immersing myself in those teachings and teachers. And then I was midway through a doctoral program in psychology when I decided that I really was called more towards, and it was not a particularly good fit for me. It was a Freudian program, not so much Jungian based, and I was frustrated. So what I felt at the time was that I was really more called to teaching. And teaching spirituality and consciousness. And I began teaching seminars and workshops and meditation retreats and, like you listed at the beginning, meditation retreats and women's retreats and couples retreats and chakra initiation retreats. And that was ultimately the path that my working journey took me on then for the rest of my career primarily.
When did you start doing the teaching? Around what years?
Well, I started teaching groups really while I was doing my bachelor's because I was part of an innovative program in my bachelor's program where it was run by a Zen Buddhist. And what we did with undergraduate students was teach meditation and assist students in opening to different states of consciousness. So really, it was in my early 20s when I began teaching and leading meditation in groups, and then it continued on from there. And
so
when I finished... Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. No, no, please.
When I finished my graduate work and was teaching, I ended up working for a consciousness organization here in the Bay Area that was modeled, it was originally created by two women, and both of whom had in-depth study of psychology and spirituality and Jungian psychology in particular, depth psychology and transpersonal psychology. So they created an organization that was modeled after the ancient mystery schools. And so we taught workshops and seminars that not only allowed people to immerse themselves in the in-depth study of the major world spiritual traditions, but also experientially through meditation and through movement and through dream work and through chanting and through ritual, actually inducted people into expanded states of consciousness.
The population of folks who are attracted to your work early on, are they much different than the ones who might be attracted to your work now?
I don't think so. I think that the people who have always been attracted to my work are seekers. You know, I also have a private practice now. I mostly have a private practice, though I do continue to teach seminars and workshops. You know, people usually step onto their path because there's some pain in their life or some trouble in their relationships, and they're trying to ease their pain and suffering, or they're trying to resolve the relationship problem that they're having. But often the people who have stayed engaged on a path with me or on their own are people who have a deeper calling, as did I, you know, who feel the presence of something greater than themselves, and they're trying to find their way to that.
Now, you had mentioned various spiritual practices that are included in your work, and you also mentioned a somatic practice like movement. I'm curious on how you integrate more of the somatic practices into your work, as well as if you could spend a little bit of time talking about how you actually do work with people, helping them find their path, or if they're already on their path, helping them to explore it more deeply.
Well, it depends on the format within which I'm working with somebody. So if somebody comes into my private practice, it's mostly talking practice, though I do some guided meditation and some breathing exercises. When I'm teaching a seminar or a meditation retreat or a workshop, I do incorporate a lot of movement. I myself have been a dancer for most of my life and at some point shifted from studying like modern dance or jazz dance and started practicing ecstatic trance dancing, which I personally found was a very deep and powerful way of accessing my own deepest truth and my own soul. And so I do incorporate movement a lot in the workshops that I teach as a nonverbal way for people to find themselves. And there's a lot of pathways into finding one's soul. It can come through movement. It can come through dream work. It can come through meditation. It can come through talking. It can come through daytime fantasies and imaginations. It can come through artwork and doing work with clay or markers and a pen or journaling. But so I utilize any and all possible ways to help a person redirect their focus from external to internal, and all possible ways of turning their inner ears on so they can hear the whispering of their own wisdom and their own soul.
Tell me a little about your work with couples. I found that when I was doing therapy as a therapist, interesting, I would think, for me at least, the work was the couples, because it was so real. And as opposed to when I work with an individual and they talked about a second person, the second person's not in the room, so it's not as real and alive as when the second person was actually in the room. And I'm curious on how you bring your very spiritual approach into work with couples.
Well, that may be my most favorite part of my work, is working with couples for that very reason, as you said, because it's all happening right there, right in the space. I think first and foremost, I find it important for them to reconnect to what it is that they love and appreciate about each other. Because until that's in the space, they're at odds with each other. So my first intention is often to have them remember what they love about each other and what they appreciate about each other and what they admire about each other. And that's a platform from which together they're much more powerful at looking at whatever the issues are that they're struggling with. But I also, and in addition to that, I find that most often people aren't very skilled at knowing how to communicate what's not working for them or what it is that they're wanting or what it is that's missing for them. That more often than not, people are inclined to talk about the other person and what the other person isn't doing right or what the other person isn't doing what they should be doing differently, which, of course, has the other person feeling blamed and made wrong and attacked, and that tends to close their heart down. So a lot of what I do with couples is help them drop into what it is that they themselves are wanting and why, and from a vulnerable, open-hearted place, begin to express from their own experience what it is that they're needing and wanting, as opposed to making their partner wrong for not being this, that, or the other. And that tends to invite the partner, it tends to invite the partner's caring and the partner's loving. So, for example, I was just talking to a woman this morning who is struggling in her marriage. And I was talking to her about how it is she talks to her husband about these issues. And she says, well, she tells him that she wishes he was different about this and he should be different about this and he should be different about that. And I said, well, tell me more about you. Why is it that you want those things and you need those things? And she started to talk about them in the marriage. She feels lonely. And then she started to explore more deeply that loneliness is a feeling that she's had for most of her life, and that because she's had that feeling of being lonely most of her life, it's particularly excruciating for her to feel it within her marriage. And so I inquired with her, what would it be like for you to talk with your husband not about what he's doing wrong, but about this loneliness and about that you feel lonely and that it's painful for you to feel that loneliness, how you imagine he would respond. And from that place, she could imagine that his caring for her would have him want to come toward her, as opposed to what's been happening is he ends up feeling judged and shamed and made wrong, and then he withdraws further, and then she feels more lonely. Does that answer your question?
It really does, and I just wrote myself a note saying we don't have a manual for being human and how to be in relationships. What's
well,
that?
That very well may be the thing that I offer people the most is that manual, and not just about being in relationship with another, but in being in relationship with themselves, in being in relationship with life. We learn a lot in our growing up, in our education, but we really do not learn how to be a human being well. And so we are highly educated and stumbling our way through the task of being human beings and being in relationship with each other and ourselves and life and the great mystery that we are involved in here. There's no roadmap. And ultimately, that is underneath whatever anybody comes into my office asking for or wanting, ultimately that's what it is. Can you help me find my way through this thing called life? Because I'm stumbling and I'm bumbling and I'm banging into things, and sometimes I find grace and sometimes I don't. And sometimes I hurt people along the way and I don't mean to and I don't know how not to do that. And that's really ultimately what ends up happening in our work.
I've been doing some writing recently, and I call an exercise that I've developed around one's dragon. And dragons are known, since you're a Jungian, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but in some traditions, to guard treasure. And I see in this exercise that I've developed that our defense mechanisms is a dragon that at one time has served us for a particular purpose, and for whatever reason no longer serves us, and it's protecting some treasure within us that if we could have access to, you know, our lives would be that much more whole and complete, and et cetera, et cetera. But in my exercise, it's not about attacking the dragon. It's actually getting to know the dragon, because the dragon is a part of yourself. Which leads me to a question. I'm curious on your take on like personalities and subpersonalities and defense mechanisms. Like, how do you conceive of things that way? If you do, can you speak to a little bit? If you don't, do you have another way of thinking about how we protect ourselves from the pain of loneliness in the case that you just gave, and not being able to connect with another person in a more deep way?
Well, that's a very big question. How much time do we have? Yeah, it's a conversation we could talk about, you know, at length for quite a while. But Because I'm more Jungian in my perspective, I do hold the point of view that we are always attempting to heal. These are always attempting to heal. And so whatever circumstances we were born into, our psyches devised the best strategy that it could at the time to meet those challenges. And that often then becomes our primary personality. It's not necessarily the whole total sum of the mystery that we are, but it's the personality that got created to meet the challenges. And as people grow up into life, often that personality can get rigidified, allowing for certain ways of being and disallowing others. And when those personality structures get rigidified, then oftentimes that's then, as we move into adulthood, where the conflicts and the troubles start to happen, because those strategies that we devised with very young psyches are not necessarily needed anymore in our adult lives. So the ways that we learn to protect ourselves aren't necessarily necessary in present time, but we haven't caught up with that reality. And so we are bringing early defense mechanisms into present time that are outdated and really can stand in the way, actually, of us getting the things that we're wanting from our life and from our relationship. And that's a crisis in a person's work when they begin to do work on themselves, because old mechanisms are needing to break down and needing to be released and needing to be surrendered. But the psyche is geared towards survival and doesn't necessarily want to let go of the things that have kept us safe and protected. And yet, the deeper psyche is always moving towards wholeness. So if the deeper psyche is moving towards wholeness, meaning that we can be the fullness of ourselves and we can be undefended and available and transparent to life fully, then there, and for a person who's on a path of conscious evolution or awakening or healing, there comes a time where those older structures have to be released. And lovingly so, as you were saying, honored for the service that they provided and their years of duty and loyalty to protecting us and keeping us from harm, and also surrendered so that a fuller self can emerge and a more available to life and available to loving self can emerge and be present in the person's life.
Nice. You had mentioned personality, and thanks to our mutual friend Gail, I've re-engaged the Enneagram. I started working with her briefly and hope to continue working with her to deepen my understanding of the Enneagram. But can you speak to how you use the Enneagram in your work?
Well, the Enneagram is a model, and of many, one of many. In its original form, as I understand it, it goes back many thousands of years. It was not intended to be a personality mapping parlor game, which is what it's largely become, but really intended to be a person's lifelong path of inquiry. And you weren't necessarily intending to determine which point you were on the Enneagram. I don't know if people who are listening know this system and how much detail I should be going into so they can be part of this conversation. But the original intent was not to necessarily know your point, but to be in the exploration as your spiritual path. Now, it was only ever handed down for most of the 3,000 or so years that it's existed through oral tradition. It wasn't, you know, until the last maybe 100 years where it started to be written about, and now there are online questionnaires you can take, and you can determine your type, and people are typing each other and typing their spouses and typing their coworkers, and it wasn't ever really intended to be that. So I hold it as a map that, along with many of the other things that I've encountered in the years of my journey, and I hold it with a loose hand. And I prefer the orient, and there are many different people who teach it and many different ways that it is talked about and many different ways that it is used. But the one that I tend to resonate with the most is that each of the 9 points of the Enneagram are a portal to one's relationship with the divine, and that each of us have our own particular gateways to accessing something numinous, something bigger than ourselves, and that the Enneagram is a way to articulate that as one of the 9 portals. And so it's just a way of looking at people that I work with, but I don't, I tend to resist any hard and fast decisions about anybody, including myself, because I think that we are evolving fluid miracles, and the aim is to be continually expanding our sense of ourselves until we know ourselves as this miraculous infinite mystery that we are a part of and an expression of. And anything that closes the portal around that infinite possibility limits the whole game.
Nice. Well said. Besides your work here in the States, working with individuals and couples and doing your groups, you also take people to sacred sites around the world. Can you speak a little bit about some of the travels that you've done, places you've been, and the discoveries that you've made?
Well, I love to travel. In fact, I'm leaving next week on a personal trip to South Africa. I'm not taking a group of people. But I have taken groups traveling to India and to Bali and to Mexico, to Chichen Itza. And I will be, I think, and there's plans in place as we're talking, to possibly take a group again to Bali next year. And I love that because, especially in cultures like India and Bali that are so different from our own, there's an opportunity to immerse oneself, especially in those two cultures in particular. A spiritual reality is just part of the air. You know, it's unlike our culture where if you have a religious practice, you go to a church. In India and in Bali in particular, the spiritual reality is everywhere. It's on the streets. It's everywhere you go. I remember in Bali being struck by, several times a day, people stop what they're doing and they go to the temple to make their offerings. That's just woven into the fabric of their being. So when I've taken groups traveling, it takes us out of our Western frame of reference and out of our Western mind, and you enter dream time. And in the space of dream time, everything becomes ritual. And so my experience when I've been traveling with people is that actually is every act is an act of prayer and every act is an act of devotion. And so somehow that reality begins to take over when you're traveling to sacred sites. And when I've taken people traveling, we spend a great deal of time in the temples and shrines wherever we're going, in ritual, in meditation, in deeper and deeper states of meditation. And so when I took a group of a group traveling to India, everyone on that trip did a very powerful ritual on the banks of the Ganges in Varanasi. And that was after much time of meditation and dream work and movement and contemplation. And each person set an intention for something that they were really wanting to have happen in their life. And within a year, every one of the people let me know that the thing that they had set a prayer for and set an intention for and meditated on had come true. And there's, you know, there's something very powerful that happens when you leave the reality of the culture you're living in and you immerse yourself in a culture that lives and breathes a spiritual reality. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, it really does. If folks are interested in learning more about your work in general, and then you, specifically your spiritually oriented travels, how would they do so?
Well, the best place to find me is by going to my website, which is www.soulwhisperer.com. So it's SOULWHISPERER.com.
Great. And you mentioned your book and your book of poetry. Can you remind us when that will be coming out?
I wish I had a date. I'm still in the editing process with the book. And so my goal is to have it out for publication sometime next year. And the poetry book will follow.
Great.
And I hope that will all be posted on my website as soon as I have dates and times for that.
Very cool. Well, Tina, I hope you'll come back and read some of your poetry to us.
That was lovely.
Tell us about your book, your other book.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael.
Well, it's great talking to you. I'm so happy that we connected. I'll have to give Gail a kiss offline and Stuart for closing the circle and bringing us all together. And I've enjoyed this conversation.
Me too, Michael. Thank you so much.
And we'll talk again.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.